Ready to go? I'm live? All right. Hello, I want to go ahead and get things started because we've actually got a lot of ground to cover. My name is Stephen White. I'm the programming director at Naughty Dog. This lecture is The Technology of Jak and Daxter. And for those of you who are not familiar with Jak and Daxter, it's an action action adventure game that takes place in one giant seamless world. And by seamless, I mean that you can walk from one end of the world essentially to any other place in the world without noticing load times. And yet we still have a high degree of detail around the player at all times. When my boss, Jason Rubin, asked me to do this talk, he said, let's do a talk on the technology of Jak and Daxter. I said, well, what in particular? He says, everything. So, well, everything's a mighty big subject. But as a dutiful employee, I am going to try to do my best to cover everything, or at least most things. As such, I'm only going to have the time to do an overview of things. And hopefully this will get you thinking about things you can do in your own games, inspire you to other things, or at least give you, a good laugh if you came up with a better solution than I did. And if you did come up with a better solution, then I'd love to hear it. Fair's fair, come on. So, Jak and Daxter was published by Sony Computer Entertainment for the PlayStation 2 in December of 2001. At its high point, it had 35 full-time developers, and it had 2 years of full production and 1 year of initial development, which was just a handful of people. The operating systems we used were Windows NT, Windows 2000, and Linux. Software we use, Allegro Common Lisp, which I'll get to later. Visual C++, GNU C++, Maya, Photoshop, Emacs, Visual Slick Edit, T-Shell, Exceed, and CVS. I want to take a moment to go over something, a topic that's near and dear to me, which is the importance of tools. In our Jak and Daxter, the individual game levels were commonly in the multi-million polygon counts. And to deal with that kind of polygon counts really requires a lot of forethought in the tool development, and it's only going to get worse with the new hardware, where maybe a billion polygon level is not, unreasonable. For us, one of the big things you need is you need data formats where the data streams can be modified or changed very easily without busting existing tools or existing files. With poor planning in this can result in a large loss of productivity. To deal with this, at the core level of our tools, we have something we call the DB for our database system. Essentially, it's a set of classes that are like container classes, very generic. They have their own kind of runtime typing information, so they can identify themselves, and they can do other nice properties. For example, they can read themselves out of a file, they can write themselves to a file, they can print themselves, they can clone or copy themselves, they have iteration support, you can add things generically to them, like multiple types of classes can be combined into a single class, all generically, and deleting as well. You can remove things out generically. Since things were tagged, we had IDs to things, you could just say, is what I'm looking for in this container? And you could get back, yes, it is, and here's a pointer to it, or no, it isn't. To generate these classes, we used what was essentially very similar to a C header file. In fact, it almost exactly followed our C syntax, but had additional keywords that we needed. So you would define your classes in what looked like C code, and then we'd run a tool that would actually build a generic or all the support methods for these classes. So it would build in a write method or a read method or whatever for you. Likewise, since our containers can contain anything, and since they can copy and clone themselves, we could add new data to our containers without busting other things that were in there or having to recompile our containers or anything like that. That meant that we literally could change our mind and decide that we wanted to add something new to a mesh, some new type of data that never existed before, and modify or add it to one container, and it could pass all the way through our tool pipeline until it got to the tool that cared about the data. Every other tool in the tool pipeline did not need to be recompiled. It would just generically pass this data through, which is a tremendous advantage. If we had to recompile our tools every time we wanted to change something, what happens? We'd never change much of anything, or we'd just lose lots of time. Likewise, since the data could print itself, we had a tool that would generically inspect our data, so we could just take a file and say, okay, let's look at this, and it could CD into the data and LS what the data was and all that, all generically. Most of our tools in our pipeline were script-driven. The reason for this is that it's very, very easy for us to add new features and options to our tools with scripts. It's, no matter how crazy an option you want, you can always come up with some command, and you can set up the data you want. The bad thing about what we did is we found that that wasn't the best interface for artists. The artists are still struggling with scripts, although they're getting better. And I think in retrospect, it would have been better to have much more visual tools for the artist. Likewise, a lot of our tools ended up building really undesirable build dependencies, because if you modified a script to tweak one little number for one little guy, then sometimes it would end up rebuilding an enormous amount of data. By design, we only had two tools that linked directly with Maya. This was one that was the start of building an object and one that was the start of building a level. And both of these tools did a fairly straightforward conversion from a Maya scene file into our DB data representation. All the other standalone tools would then use our DB data, so they did not have to deal with anything to do with Maya's representation or extracting information from Maya. This insulated our tools, which kept us protected from changes in Maya, peculiarities of Maya, or having to link in with Maya's libraries. It also allowed us to slightly cook and streamline our data to just the things we were interested in, so we weren't keeping around a bunch of data we weren't interested in. And it kept all of our tools nice and consistent. We had many tools in our pipeline. I'm not going to go over them here, but basically, there's visibility, stripping tools, object processing tools, all the stuff you'd expect. All this is in the notes, the preceding notes, so you can take a look at that later at your convenience. Things we didn't do right with our tools is we didn't use a PC farm for Jack and Daxter, and this was a big mistake. Really, I highly recommend to everybody, when you think about your tools, think about distributing your processing. We overburdened our network. We didn't make use of local drives nearly as much as we should have for processing data. And as I mentioned before, we had a lot of poorly constructed data dependencies. So minor changes could end up with a lot of building. And we hit one big surprise to us, which was that file time date stamp checking under Windows is hellaciously slow. And we had kind of built our system around automation of if a file changed, then we know that's a dependency, and it ended up really biting us. We also really underestimated the difficulty of managing the audio, and that's kind of a tradition at NIDOG. We always underestimate our audio. So we held true, and because when we make the games of this grand scope, just every single sound is not necessarily difficult to deal with, but when you're dealing with thousands and thousands and thousands of sounds, make good tools. And then also our FMA sequence processing was really difficult and time-consuming because it was a hack on our normal idle, our normal animation processing. All right, to establish some terminology, we internally refer to two things distinctly as background versus foreground. We typically refer to things that are mainly static as background, such as ground, cliff, rocks, things like that. And we typically refer to things that can move around as foreground, such as an enemy, which may seem like an arbitrary distinction, but it actually governs how we develop all of our internal renderers. At the core of our level of detail technology is something that we refer to as a T-face, which is just a tessellating face. This is our own kind of primitive that can dynamically tessellate based on the distance to the camera. This means that we can, of course, have the high detail that we want very up close, but we want to collapse down to a low detail in the distance. Our two primitive types were T-face quads and T-face tries. T-face quads were essentially a grid of polygonal quads. They were 1, 2, or 4 quads wide by 1, 2, or 4 quads tall, such as a 1x4, 2x2. Here's kind of a simple graphic representation. So you can see these are actually, our T-face is a composition of a grid of quads. In fact, that's how they're modeled in Maya. The artists would actually model polygonal quads, and then we built several custom plugins that would allow them to show that they are work with them as T faces and follow particular rules we have that we needed for them to be T faces. And then we provide them with other tools for, you know, UV setting and corner color values and things like that. The T face quad tessellation is very simple. At a 4x4 T face quad, 16 quads up close, as it goes off into the distance, reduces to a single quad, which gives us a 93.75% reduction in detail, which is pretty good. Likewise, we have T-face tries, which had 1, 2, or 4 subdivisions per edge. For example, a 1x4x2 triangle. You see, here's a representation of that, the subdivision. We, once again, this was modeled in Maya, but this time the artist modeled it as a single triangle and then used our custom plugins that tessellated that triangle into the exact configuration we needed in order for our technology to work. So we have very specific tessellation rules. A grid of quads is easy for an artist to understand, but trying to do something very complex tessellation of a try is very difficult to understand. So they would model things as tries, they would run our plugin, which would tessellate it, and then they could play with the extra detail vertices, pulling them out and getting whatever detail they wanted out of the try. Once again, 4x4x4 is 16 triangles up close, reduces to a single triangle in the distance. Once again, 93.75% reduction of detail. Sony is also in the process of patenting how exactly we do the tessellation of our T-faces, the methodology we use on that. So if you have any questions on that, you can email me or you can contact Sony. We gather our tessellating our T-faces together into something called T-fragments, or tessellating fragments. This is a collection of T-face tries and quads. It's for unique things that are not instant, so it occurs only once in the game, such as the ground you walk on would be a good example, or specially designed cliff walls and things like that. The tools then would take game level, which has this big sheet of T-faces, non-instant T-faces, and would break it, strip them and break them up so that it would fit into the vector unit memory size constraints that we had for the renderer. For the lighting, we indexed all of the geometry of a level, indexed 1,024 color palette to get its corner cutter lighting, and I'll talk about more about that later. The renderer itself was not a single renderer for TFrag. It was actually done through multiple optimized renderers. An obvious example of that is things that are far enough away from the camera that they are completely reduced down to single quads or single tries could be stripped together and dealt with as a normal polygonal strip. But we also had other ways of dealing with straddle conditions. Oh, nice. Terrific. All right. All right, it is panicked. Hold on. One moment, please. All right, for T fragments, we had two supported effects, which was opaque and translucent. Translucent T frag was not sorted, so draw order could be wrong. It was fairly arbitrary how the draw order happened, although it was consistent each time it rendered. And in practice, this wasn't as bad as you might think. We had an underwater level that was filled with windows, and you could see windows from other windows, and boy, they sorted the wrong way all the time, and no one mentioned it. Now, maybe you're all just kind, but no one seemed to notice. T-frag collision was modeled as T-faces simply for convenience sake, but was converted by the tools to triangles. The artist could optionally model, they could optionally just declare this T-frag I've modeled for background is also collision, or they can model custom collision, which is really useful because if you model a pebble collision for a pebble and then you sprinkle 1,000 pebbles, you know, that's not very good use of your collision polygons. Only one collision model was modeled for all of TFrag, but the tools broke up the pieces into a spatially subdivided tree, and we had our own parallelization of it, so we actually walked the tree 8 nodes at a time for efficiency's sake. We also had instancing, whereas you model a tree and then you use it, you know, maybe 100 times in your scene. So one model instance multiple times, and then lit differently. The prototypes for our, we call this TIE for TFrag Instance Engine. The prototypes were modeled as T-face tries and quads. They were placed in Maya using something we called ref nodes, which is very similar to Maya's references, but we essentially just used locator nodes that were specially named and had certain attributes, and our tools would look for those. And what that is, let's say you wanted to have a scene that had 1,000 trees in it. Well, if you had all 1,000 trees at full detail in Maya, then Maya chugs to a halt. So instead, we have this system where they could place these nodes in their scene that represented the trees, and then they could optionally select those nodes and expand them as desired. So if they're going to work on the trees over by the hut, they could select the nodes with the trees by the hut and say expand. It brings in the detailed geometry of the trees. They could play with them, you know, move them around, whatever they need to do. And then they could collapse the whole thing back down again and work on some other portion of the scene. Each TIE instance was lit individually, but was then mapped to a single 128-color palette per prototype, and I'll talk about that more later. The TIE renderers were essentially instanced TFrag, but used specialized renderers, and the supported effects were opaque, translucent, environment-mapped through the generic renderer, which I'll talk about later. TIE collision was modeled identically to TFrag collision, but each TIE prototype had its own collision mesh or no collision at all. So you'd model one mesh for the tree, and then every instance of the tree would end up using that same collision. We had another renderer called the shrub renderer, which we used to draw shrubs, but we also used it to draw any kind of small detail that we wanted this fast rendering of. The data format closely matched what the GS was used to draw, which is how we got it to go really fast. It was instanced. These things were fairly small. You know, you could upload part of the model. You could draw multiple times. Very fast. We modeled it as tries and quads in Maya. We placed them just with our ref node system, just like we were placing the trees and everything else. And we also made a custom plugin that would let the artists randomly populate an area of ground, giving statistics about what kind of shrubs you might find there. So you just set up the statistics, go, boom, you've got your forest, your meadow. Our lighting was fairly simplistic on them. We just had a color multiplier used to kind of simulate what the ambient light in that area was. Very, very simplistic. But our supported effects were opaque and translucent. Also, the shrubs could become a single quad, or what we call poster, as they moved in the distance. So at a far level of detail, they would actually crossfade or switch to a poster. And also, at a certain level of detail, we would fade them away, because really, we only cared about these small details directly around the player. We didn't care about trying to draw them far in the distance. We also played with their matrices before we drew them to simulate a wind going through them. So we would just shear their matrices, and we got a nice little moving in the breeze motion to them. The background was pre-lit up to 8 times using Maya. An artist would light the level, then save the lighting information to our own custom level color database. The reason why we lit it 8 times was typically for 8 time of day lighting. The artist would light it for sunset, they light it for dawn, they light it for afternoon, up to 8 times. And then the runtime could interpolate between two palettes for the appropriate time of day. That way we could get a 24-hour day. The TFrag vertices, as I mentioned before, indexed a 1,024-color palette, and that was generated by lerping together two palettes for the right time of day. The TIE vertices indexed the 128-color palette, generated the same way. And then we also used our time of day for other things like caustic effects and flickering lights, like a flickering torch. It all worked through the same system. We also had a few other miscellaneous background renders, which was like a sky render, which was really just we had a sky painted to the inside of a pyramid, and you stared at the inside of the pyramid. We had an ocean render, which had a giant tessellating grid. Nearby polys were translucent, while very short out in the distance from you. It didn't seem too noticeable, though. They became opaque for efficiency reasons. And then, of course, we had a layer of environment mapping. We placed our enemies in our game using Maya, once again, just like our ref nodes. They would place specially named locator nodes, and then our tools would assign them a unique ID. So if you placed a grunt, the tools would say, well, guess what, that's grunt 67, and then that was persistent across the entire game. And you could refer to that grunt as the name grunt 67. Then for attributes for our enemies, we had that in hand-type level configuration script. So if you want to set how fast the grunt runs, you could say, oh, for actor grunt 67, his run speed is whatever you want. Of course, we had curves for a variety of things like paths and stuff like that. Navigation. This were our levels, as I mentioned before, were easily in excess of a couple million polygons per game area, which makes it, you know, a tricky problem to have enemies look intelligent as they maneuver around that complex 3D world. What we chose to do is to use a two-dimensional mesh which described where the player or where the enemy could travel, and it was had pre-cooked information about connectivity and which was the fastest way to go from any area of the mesh to any other area of the mesh. So the computation at runtime was extremely fast for an enemy to figure out how to track to any other point on its mesh. That is worthy of a whole discussion of itself. It is described in great detail in the Game Programming Gems 3 book, so check it out. Of course, we had volumes, which we modeled as polygonal meshes that we used for a variety of things, such as visibility and detecting whether somebody hit water at runtime. Then for foreground elements, our renderer we used was called Merc, which was created and programmed by Mark Cerny, who's in the audience right now. And this engine was used for enemies, platforms, anything that moved. The artist modeled our characters as polygonal meshes composed of either tris or quads, and then we could have those meshes bound to joints with up to 3 joints of influence per vertex. So any vertex could be transformed, weighted against up to 3 joints. We also had the ability for the vertices to be deformed using blend shapes. So the blend shapes, of course, are, if you're not that familiar with them, you can model different expressions for characters, and then the artist can blend in the effects of the different blend shapes in order to get our animated FMA characters, or potentially to make some changes in the in-game characters. We use separate models for different levels of detail. Basically, we'd have one or more models for each enemy or platform or whatever in the game, and at certain distances, they would pop to a different lower detail model. Typically, we had about 3 levels of detail per enemy. And the popping drives me crazy, but no one else seems to really care, but that's how we did it. And the far end of the distance, the enemies would become translucent and fade out once again, so it wasn't too jarring when they first came into existence. We also composited together the eyes by compositing eyelids, pupils, and irises, and those could be animated within Maya by the artists. I talked about Merc blend shapes. I've covered that. All right, the Merc renderer, support effects on it were opaque, limited unsorted translucency, environment mapping through the generic renderer, which I will still get to, UV scrolling, rippling, which is essentially taking multiple sine waves and just passing them through a grid of vertices. And this is how we did our water, not the ocean, but every other water you saw in the game was just sine waves going through, accumulating through a grid. And then, obviously, vertex deformation using joints and vertex deformation using blend shapes. For the foreground lighting, we had 3 dynamic lights per Merc object. We also had a global RGBA multiplier and an RGBA add, so we could fade them up, we could, you know, add in addition of color as desired with the multiplier and the add. And then we also could plug in the time of day directional lighting if we wanted the lighting to be relative to like the sun, for example. For foreground collision, we used multiple collision meshes allowed per actor. The collision meshes were modeled as polygonal meshes in Maya using tris or quads, and each collision mesh was transformed in runtime using only a single joint, so there was no deformation of our collision meshes. We could also optionally use collision spheres bound to individual joints. that were set up in code rather than in Maya, because it was just much easier for us to get a turnaround iteration of us setting up our own collision spheres. Enemies predominantly use collision spheres. Things like platforms, of course, use collision meshes. Shadows. The artist would model a simplified, a very simple representational model to cast the shadow of, you know, of an enemy to cast a shadow. That model could be deformed, but only by two joints maximum. And so the artist would model this simple shape, and then we would take the direction of the light source, and we'd extrude the model out in the opposite of the direction of the light source, or in the direction of the light source. And that would create a volume. Then we would go through and eliminate inner edges in that volume until we got a fairly simple volume. And then we would use that with the classic shadow volume approach of using the alpha mask and, you know, using the z-buffer and the alpha mask in order to determine which pixels ought to be darkened, and then we just darken off the alpha mask. We also had a sprite renderer, which could do 2D sprites and simple 3D sprites. It could also do what we call distortion sprites, which gave kind of a simplistic refraction by basically reading what was underneath it and stretching it in some way, which we used for like heat effects and blurs. The generic renderer. Well, due to the incredibly large number of renderers we created for the different situations, all of our different formats, all of our different distances from the camera, it became very impractical to implement certain effects across all the renderers. So we came up with a generic renderer. This is a slower format, but that it's a format that is fairly easy to write by the other renderers. So the other renderers, when faced with a difficult problem, could write what they needed or could be written out using convert to the generic renderer. And then the generic renderer, although running more slowly, could tackle the trickier issues. Some examples, we use that for environment mapping are scissoring, which is just the triangular subdivision against, you know, the view frustum. Visibility, the occlusion culling. As everyone knows, something exists behind the wall behind me, but I can't see it, you know, so why draw it? Why consider it? And that's for occlusion culling. We believe in IADA, firmly believe, you know, the more you can pre-compute on your visibility, the better. So we try to pre-compute in our tools as much information as possible, so the runtime has to do the least amount of work as possible. What we did is we actually computed with portals, took in a level, computed with portals what we thought we could see from through each of the different portals. And we came up with a bitwise representation, so bit strings, that said, I can see this shrub, I can see this tie, I can see this piece of tfrag, all this as a big series of bits. And that might seem crazy, because that might seem like an enormous amount of data to have these huge bit strings all over our world. You know, if the camera is in this one space, here's your bit string. But in practice, it actually wasn't so bad because you can compress those strings, and they compress extremely well. And it's actually not that slow to decompress the bit string for a given area of the camera. So essentially in the runtime, we took the position of the camera, looked up through a BSP tree what bit string to use, and that told us what to draw, and then we could just run right down following that bit stream in exact order, say draw, don't draw, draw, don't draw. For actor, describing where an actor was visible, we used an axis-aligned bounding box that was essentially wrapped around everywhere the actor could be seen. And so when we did our pre-computed, our visibility computation, this is pre-computed, we would just check to see if that axis-aligned box was visible, which is a pretty rough way of doing it, but it worked all right. To generate the box, you could do it by hand by typing it. That was pretty awful. Or you could actually run the game for a while and see where the enemy went, and it would expand his box over time, and that got a pretty good approximation where the enemy was visible. Spooling. We spooled a large amount of data in our game, because at the core of our game is we wanted to have no perceivable or very few perceivable load times. To do this, we had 2 10-megabyte data level buffers, and that's not a game level, that's a data level. One game level could be actually broken up internally into multiple data levels, and we did do that on several occasions. But I'm just going to refer to it as a level. what we did then is we had these two data levels. You had to have loaded so you could render out the level that the player was currently in. Then as the player approached another level, we would set up and start loading that level in the other buffer. Now if the player changed his mind and went towards backwards and went towards a different level, then we would abandon the load that we were doing to the other buffer, the one level, and then start loading the new level that the player was headed towards. We had to use very careful planning then to ensure that no more than two data levels were ever visible at any one time. In order to make the decisions about whether to load new data or to display new data, we had what were called load boundaries, which were like invisible fences. They're essentially just a bunch of planes chained together like a fence. The player crossed one of those planes, it would say, oh, you better start loading this level. If you got further in and crossed another plane, it'd say, oh, you better start drawing this level. Now, we also wanted, though, that you would get the impression that you could see something, you know, a mile off in the distance, and you can in the game, and you could keep your eye on that thing and walk all the way up to it. Well, that could actually straddle multiple levels. So the trick we did on that is we had low-resolution models that were actually part of the level data you were in. So if you could see the jungle tower a mile off in the distance, there was a low-resolution version of the jungle tower in your current level. And then we would pop it when you switch levels, but people don't seem to notice the popping so much. For our spooled level data, we spooled in the obvious things, background geometry, collision, textures, our visibility strings, foreground geometry, its collision, its textures, its animations, certain sounds for the level. We also spooled in our code. We have our own custom compiler, I'll get to that later, that allows us to bring in code very, very trivially. And so our code is saved out as data that is then imported with the level. So creature-specific code, you only pay the price of that code in the level that has that creature. We also spooled other data that was not part of the level data, which was like certain lengthy animations, like when Jack got bored and did his little idles. Those were spooled. Our FMA sequences, you know, which had multiple high-resolution model characters, were spooled along with its audio. And then for certain lengthy sound effects, we would spool those as well. All right, our custom compiler, we call it GOL, stands for Game Object Assembly Lisp. GOL is based on the Lisp language, well, actually Scheme, but most people are lucky if they've heard of Lisp. Very few people have heard of Scheme. Practically all of the runtime of our game was written in GOL. That was approximately 500,000 lines of code. The only thing that we wrote in C++ in the runtime was our IOP code and a very small amount of kernel code that interfaced with certain Sony libraries and bootstrapped our compiler. GOL is an object-oriented language, extremely powerful, yet simple syntax, makes it really easy to parse if you want to do custom parsing, really easy to do macros, can do very, very powerful macros. It's far superior to C's preprocessor or C++'s templates. You can do much more with Lisp than you can in C++. We also had a listener where code could be executed live at the listener. You could type any instruction, any runtime code at all, write at a prompt, and it would download to the PlayStation 2, execute on the PlayStation 2, and return the results to you. That meant that our code can be compiled, downloaded, and linked without interrupting gameplay. That meant we could we do this all the time, we could work on creatures without ever quitting the program. So we'll start going in and adding new states and new behaviors and adding all the work, debugging and all that, all without quitting the program. Our data structures could be inspected or modified live, essentially at the listener. It's all there. It's all readily available. So we could just say, you know, print whether the contents of this, change the contents of that, all live. This gives us an enormous advantage in rapid tuning and debugging. We had built into it a non-preemptive cooperative multitasking scheme. And by that, I just simply mean that if an enemy was running, it could do what it wanted to do for that frame. And then in the code, we had a suspend statement. So it could say, I'm done for now. Start me up again next frame. And it would allow other things to run. And when the next game frame came around, it would continue from after beyond the suspend statement. And it's actually an incredibly powerful thing, because if you were to look at our code, we can write really complex AI behaviors, and it's all linear. We don't do the clunky callbacks, like having an update method of our C++ class that goes, okay, what was I doing? You know, cases out what it was doing. Okay, now I'm going to do that a little bit more. Now I'm going to return. Instead, we literally do this, suspend, do this, suspend, do this, suspend. And then we can wrap up functionality such as playing animations and macros so that it suspends even embedded. So we can just say, play this anim. And it will increment our frame number, suspend. You know, very simple. Likewise, we had local variables that could be preserved across the suspend, so you didn't have to like clutter up your C++ classes with the whatever you needed for a particular enemy. You just declared it as a local variable. And we had extensive support for AI scripting. The goal also had a unified set of assembly opcodes consistent across all five processors of the PS2. So an ad was an ad. Didn't matter what processor it was. This drastically simplified looking at our code and working with our code. You could also seamlessly intermix high-level code with low-level assembly. So you could have any high-level construct that had assembly built right into it. And I'm not talking about ASM statements. I mean, there's no distinction between a high-level thing and an assembly instruction. And because of that, our register coloring worked across the assembler instructions as well. So you didn't have to work with specific registers unless you wanted to. And like I mentioned before, our code itself was written out in a way that it could be loaded as part of the LATA and live patched in. So as you went into a new level, the new code got loaded in, and as soon as it got loaded in, it just live swapped in like you typed it at our listener. The difficulties with Goal. Well, it took over a year to write, and it was fully developed and supported by one person. And that one person could have spent his time doing a lot of other really cool things. And also, it's only understandable, the compiler, by one person, which is very dangerous for a large company. So I don't necessarily recommend that course. We also suffered with a buggy and quirky compiler as Goal was being developed, just plagued with bugs initially. It's a very unfamiliar language for programmers to use. It makes hiring really interesting at times. Because like, so how's your Lisp? You know, it just doesn't come up often in game interviews. And it can have a difficult learning curve. It also isolated us from other developers, which is, you know, we joined the Sony family fairly recently. And they're like, great, let's see your code. It's like, how's your Lisp? and then likewise, the compiler uses a garbage collection scheme, and it had the annoying habit of running out of memory and then stalling for several minutes, as in maybe 15 or 20 minutes, before it come back, which is a whole lot of fun if you're debugging something and you're just a few instructions away from understanding the problem. Okay, phew. Well, I've rushed through this, as you can tell it's an overview, but I really wanted to get to the questions, because I think I've probably brought up more questions than answered things. I was also going to do a very shameless plug, so I'm going to look away for a second. Oh, what's that? Hold on. Okay, so any questions?
I have a question.
Yes. No, you literally, the question is, how does the suspend function work, to summarize here? And literally, you write out the code you want to do this frame, you do the work you want to do this frame, and then at any point when you say suspend, you're cooperatively saying, I'm done, but I want to resume after the suspend. So you could write, like as simple examples, if you wanted to play an animation, and if you break that down to the basics, you want to increment a frame number, right? That's pretty much what you want to do. If you're looping, you want to reset it if it hits your maximum. You could say, increment my frame number, suspend. You know, and wrap that in a loop. So you say, start of loop, increment my frame number, suspend, and ending the loop, right? So it would increment, hit the suspend, go away for the frame, come back.
Curious how suspend works at a higher level.
Suspend, the question is, how does Suspend work on a higher level, like something navigating around the world? Well, the thing is, you got to think of it as, I've got a certain amount of work I want to do, and then I'm done for now, and then I want to resume next game frame. So part of that work might be update my path, update my movement, and continue. The difference is, we never had to deduce what we were doing. We didn't have like a generic update call and then go, okay, well, what was I doing before? All right, now that I figured out what I was doing, I'm going to do a little more of it. Instead, your code looks very straightforward of whatever you feel like in your loop with a suspend. And so you can do any kind of updating, anything you want, all in the straightforward. You can do like play this anim, followed by this anim, by followed by this anim. It's all very linear. So, any questions? Question is, how do you learn more about goal, which is also, am I a masochist, right? No, previous game developer conference, there was an entire lecture on goal. So you can look at those game developer proceedings from that year. I think it was like 4 years ago. And if you're curious about it, the guy who wrote it will probably talk your ear off about it. So just email me, and I'll put you in touch with him. Available for license? Once again, the question is, am I a masochist? if you can work something out, but I would think not. I think the best thing to do is just learn whether you think doing that yourself is a good idea or not. There were questions, hand back here in the back. Okay, question was that I mentioned that file time date stamp checking was hellaciously slow, and it was a shocker to us. It was amazingly slow, many factors slower than we'd ever assumed. To do it again, I would actually keep track of the timestamps in my own database. So I would have a master database that kept track of components and would timestamp it. Now, obviously, that doesn't work for things that the artists edit. So if they edit like a targa, you're still in trouble because it's not going to automatically update your database if the target changed. But for a lot of our data was put through a tool's pipe that was several stages. And usually when you rebuilt a level, you only built portions of what had changed, you know, rebuilt the portion that had changed. That data came from our tool, so easily could have been logged as to what the time date stamps were. Let's get way back in the back, the red shirt standing. The question is that I mentioned that on a certain case, the artists would have to tessellate within the tools to get the right T-face try configuration, and then they could play with the extra detail that the tools generated, because they would model a single try, they would run our plugin, it would tessellate it into the high detail that is possible, and then they would move the vertices, and the question was, well, what happens if you change your mind and want to redo it? For T-face tries, it was kind of tough luck, it's not a great answer, but they would essentially, if they were going to change their mind, it meant their detail probably didn't matter so much for that try anyhow, as we were hoping, and so they would just select the whole triangle, clap, you know, remove the detail out of it, and then re-hit it again for what new thing they wanted. That's good. You're behind, not the front row, but second row. The question is did all the time we spent with the compiler, did we get that back and increase productivity? I would say yes, but it was painful. It's not necessarily a road I recommend. It's one thing it has proved to me is that C++, although beautiful in many ways, has major shortcomings and is really not a good language for doing enemy behavior. We've proved it. Our language is actually, anyone who started using it, it's far superior for doing enemy behavior. However, the disadvantages of developing your own compiler, maintaining your own compiler, being separated from the rest of the world, not being able to use things you hear about or having to convert everything to your thing, it's a tough road. You know, it's got its ups and downs. In front?
This is a question about
No, every single, the question is, was for writing enemy behaviors, were the enemies a single threat or multiple threats? Every enemy was considered a process. In fact, it was derived off of a process-based class. Hence how the suspend works, is it runs the process for a while until the process suspends, and the next frame it continues from where it left off. So no, every enemy ran its single process, for efficiency reasons. When you start getting into multi-processing, you can do some very clever things, but a lot of times it becomes really complicated and maybe inefficient. Question? Let's go over here. Yes, you. I attended the Python lecture, not this year, but a couple years ago or last year. And the question is would we continue in the future to use Goal, or would we maybe switch to something more commonly, widely accepted, such as Python? And Python is another good proof that C++ is not necessarily the best way to write clean, easy-to-understand enemy AI behavior code. Python has a lot of abilities very similar to Goal. It has a lot of the very same types of things. Python also has its own weaknesses and limitations. I don't think we'd switch to Python. I think it's too slow for our needs. Goal is really down to the metal fast when it needs to be, and maybe I haven't given Python enough look, but I don't think from the lecture I attended that Python really is quite that down to the metal. You have a follow-up real quick? Okay, I'll look again. I love to be proven wrong, actually. So, question way in the back. I can't hear you, I'm sorry. Lure, L-U-R-E? L-U-A. Okay, I'll give it a look. Like I said, I love being proven wrong. Absolutely love it. So you never hurt my feelings proving me wrong. On this side here, in the aisle. Oh. This is a very good question. Is what denoted a bit in our bit string for visibility? Like a bit represented what? And the density on that is like an obvious one is a tie. If you have a tree that is a tie, we had a bit per tree. Less obvious perhaps is, remember tfrag was our non-instance thing. Well, that was split and broken up into pieces that would easily be digested by the vector unit. We had a bit per one of those as well. And then furthermore, you could do bit per shrubs and things like that. So they're large strings, but compressed. Remember, compressed, they're very small. Oh, no. Are you talking about how we actually did our pre-computing? It was actually done through portals, and there's been a lot of talks on how, and we did basically what everybody else is doing, or at least similar, which is an analysis of portals going from one shape to another shape, and they had our own bend on it, but that was essentially it. In front here?
In the game, you had portals taking you in between different areas of the world. I was wondering why you weren't able to load up these other areas of the world in the second buffer while you were approaching the portal. Why did it have to go into the load time when you went through the portals?
Now, the question is, we had load times when we're taking a portal to go to another area of the world, and why? I don't remember an example.
For example, when you're taking the portal to the very beginning.
We call them warp gates, those big round things you jump through on that. All right, well, that's where our completely seamless load time falls apart. basically, it was not always possible that you could successfully approach a portal and have us be able to free the second buffer, so the second buffer was still in use. If we had been really, really clever about placement of that, that would be theoretically possible. We maybe weren't so clever, or if we just kind of accepted it. Let's take someone from the back here. Here? Yes. The question is, was the visibility calculated across levels? And absolutely, and what a pain. So basically, we had a notion of levels that could see other levels. And so we had that kind of a connectivity notion. And when we wanted to do full visibility of a level, it had to import its geometry into the tools as well as the connected geometry. and then run the visibility, which made our visibility stage take several hours to run a single level. And that is, once again, back to my original point of the PC farm, parallel processing. Do it. Start that way in your tools. Because it would have been a fairly easy problem to have imported it and broke it up across multiple machines, but we ran it on one machine. I guess the wall here?
Concerning goal, how did you handle the code problem where, say, you had C++ code that would call a procedure for the goal and vice versa? Did you release stubs like handwritten functions, or did the goal come around?
So the question is, how did we deal with C functions that wanted to call goal functions? And or vice versa. The easy one is that goal functions had a way that they registered functions so that they could be used. And that had to do with the fact that we could download a function at any time and install it live. And so it was just a simple matter of matching that. So the C functions that we wanted exposed, we could register them so that goal could use them. The other way around, we didn't do. And you got to think of the mentality is, when we did the Crash Bandicoot games, we did the engine in C, and we did our behavior in a similar language to goal. And what we found is that we could do pretty much everything in the enemy behavior language, and we finally just took the plunge and said, okay, what if we didn't use C? Now, obviously, you have to use it for bootstrapping, but what if we just did everything in our own language and we tailored it to exactly what we need, and if anything was difficult for us, we just changed the compiler. And we took that mentality. So really, it didn't go the other way. I mean, there are ways to do it, of course. You could set your registers up properly and call it, but we just didn't, typically. So, right here?
You mentioned that when you loaded levels, you loaded everything from geometry, collision, texture, sound, animation. Did you do anything to take care of shared resources? For example, sound files would be used in multiple levels, but not in the third level?
Yeah, the question is, we loaded everything for a level, including sound, collision, geometry, textures, things like that. How do we deal with shared resources? That's a big subject. Our system was very simplistic in that it just loaded a ton of stuff. And once it arrived, you had access to it and would patch itself in, and it was as if it had always been there. And the issue then is, if you had two things adjacent to each other, how do you tell which is the one you wanted? You know, if you have the grunt's behavior, base class behavior, in level A, but that's adjacent to level B, and level B brings in the grunt's base class behavior, what happens? We were just careful and didn't do that. So yeah, no. So we did very careful organization. When we broke up our levels, we were very careful to make sure that we create something called packages, which was like almost like libraries, and we would load in the package for a level, and then we knew it was already loaded. If, you know, if A had the package, we knew B didn't need it. And we could have been more clever than that, but it really just kind of worked for us. I want to hit the person in the back here. Oh, you had your hand before. I guess not. Okay. Anybody else?
Another question. How did you handle, did you write your own sound library for the CPU?
Oh, thank goodness, no. We use Sony's library, which is the Buzz Burrows. I don't know if you're familiar with Buzz Burrow at all. He's the sound guy at Sony. We use his stuff, which is fantastic. Boy, what a relief, because we'd always done it ourselves in the past, basically, and we wouldn't have had the time. And he's done a much better job than we would have done with his focus to attention. Let me get over here. Oh, for the collision data. No, it wasn't an awk tree. It's strange. we've just made use of the fact, one of the things we like to do at Naughty Dog is we like to have all the processors going as often as we can, and so we like to really think of parallelizing everything we're doing. And the structure of it is really odd in that it's a tree with similar to an awk tree in that it's got eight leaves, but it's not exactly the same. I mean, you can talk about it more offline. It's weird, so... I think you've had your hand up for a while, actually.
Yeah, I was just wondering about how you did the LEDs. You said you had these, like, T-faces that did some of the dynamic LEDs, but you also talked about levels that you could see from other levels. Were they just, like, hand-drawn, or did you have some way of generating those offline or whatever?
The question is, when you could see a level far off in the distance, was that generated or was that hand-drawn for the simplified level detail? It was hand-drawn. So we used Maya to generate it. That's my answer. It wasn't done through tools. So they went into Maya and they imported the high detail one and they just did a poly reduction and they did a little cleanup and called it good. It realistically, it just didn't take that long. So it was fine. And the artist too, if we write a tool that does reduction, I have yet, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe someone's got the greatest reduction tool ever, but the artists always hate it. They're like, what have you done to my model? This doesn't look like this. That parapet was important, you know, and they just get really upset. And it's just, we're happier, they're happier to let them do it.
Yeah, I just thought it'd be a lot of work to remodify the LEDs.
No, because you really don't see that many tall. The question is, would it be a lot of work to remodify the LEDs? And the thing is, you don't see that much poking above the treetops, right? So, and they're pretty major items. And we don't, you know, if they carve a little bit out of something, we don't care, you know? I want to hit something I haven't hit. In the aisle back here? Yes, you. The question is, how do we avoid runtime garbage collection? Well, the answer is the runtime didn't garbage collect. The runtime, the Go compiler compiled native code. We memory managed our own memory. The garbage collection was the compiler itself. So the compiler, when it would do things like compile your code, would generate a whole bunch of stuff that it would just then leave for the garbage collector to collect. And you know, anyone who's dealt with garbage collectors know that's a problem. actually, there was somebody else over here that's been waiting for a while. Was it you? Yes? I can't hear you. I'm sorry.
Talking about the people in quad, are you suggesting that the modeler is actually kind of modeled with patches?
Yeah, you could call what we did patches. I mean, that's certainly a good term for it. They're a type of surface which is just modeled as a subdivision of quads. The question is, did the artists model our T-faces like patches? Well, yeah, they modeled them knowing what the technology was in mind. They could model not thinking too much about it because they knew they could fix what they had most of the time. So they could just model as quads if they wanted to, and then they would use our plugins and say, okay, take this whole bunch of quads and make these 4x4 T-faces. And it would go boom and make them all 4x4 T-faces. Or it might have a gap, and they would go and repair the gap. Is someone over here? Yes. Remember that we had, the question is, did we have the T-face technology at the start of the project? No. Remember that we had 1 year of pre-production with just a handful of people. And during that 1 year, that handful of people were programmers. And they spent their time trying to develop the engine. Because it would not be financially, you know, beneficial to us to have a bunch of artists generating stuff they can't use. So spend a year developing our underlying technology. Now that technology changed many times, but that's part of the, you know, the cycle of doing a project. No, we tried to develop in advance of the artist coming, but we didn't have it right off the start. Yes.
Which was harder to deal with, the frame rate or lack of memory?
The question is, which is harder to deal with, frame rate or lack of memory? Wow. How about equally? I don't know how to answer that any better. I mean, they were both. Well, at NIDOG, one of the things that we try to do is push as many polygons as we possibly can, which then, of course, affects our frame rate. But we're very polygon pushing driven. Our concept is get more polygons out there, and that gives us more ability to look nice. And so we're always concerned about frame rate. At the same time, when we did like Crash Bandicoot, Crash Bandicoot 3 had 8 bytes of free RAM when we shipped it. So, I mean, we were going in looking at, you know, moving code around to optimize the code to free up a few more bytes. Yeah. So we're always worried about memory as well. It's never enough. Question is, did we write tools for profiling? Yes, we did. I wish they had been better. I mean, we had a various collection of timing routines where we could time things, and we had things where were interrupt-driven, where it would sample what memory was in, what routine it was in. It would just sit there and ping and figure out what memory was in, and then it kept a statistic and things like that. a really crude area of improvement for us, definitely. Let's get someone who hasn't. Question before? Well, if you remember, I had my lawyers are evil slide. That one, if you want the specifics on that, I really recommend that you you can send me an email or talk to Sony if you want to look at the specifics. But the exact way, the question is how exactly did we tessellate our T-faces? And how exactly we did it, we're patenting. So I hope that what we're doing is inspirational, and you can come up with your own ways to do it, but our exact tessellation is being patented. The question is, how do we manage our coordinate systems across the whole thing? Are you talking about translation values or UV values?
I'm particularly worried about precision and managing precision over such a huge world.
Yeah, it was actually a big problem. We had world coordinates uniform across the entire game. So each vertex had the world coordinates, and we used 4,096, a value of 4,096, essentially as 1 meter, if you want to think of it in fixed point terms. But in floating point, we use floating point. And we ran into trouble. If you got into the snow level, which was very, very far from the origin of the world, you would find that a creature would go to throw something at you, and what he'd throw would be offset, like a meter, from his hand. And we go, what's going on? And we ended up compensating through some math tricks to try to bring it in line, but frankly, if we'd gone another, you know, a third further into along, it would just gotten progressively worse and it might have become unsolvable. So, yeah, that's a big problem. I really hope that we all move to higher precision floating points soon, and hardware-wise. Any other questions? Oh, okay, yes. Well, the question is a new programmer who's never used Lisp or Scheme, how long would it take to learn it? And it's actually kind of an interesting question, because another question would be, how long would it take to learn Goal? And Goal is not exactly Lisp or Scheme. For learning Goal, we found in practice it varies widely in programmers, but usually within about 3 weeks to a month and a half, they're pretty productive, maybe a little grumpy, but pretty productive. And then by, you know, 3 months in, they're really happy and going, wow, I never thought I could do something this way. And by 6 months, they're going, how did I ever not, you know, how did I live without this functionality? So, but, you know, you'll get different opinions. For a learning curve, yeah, it takes a while. Any more questions? We are actually over time right now, but any more questions? And I'll stick around, too, if anyone has questions. I think I'm going to end it out. I'll stick around. Okay. Here, let me...